This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on ABC Radio National. I'm Daniel Browning. Thanks for your company. It's been 3 years since 15-year-old Errol Wiles Jr. was struck and killed by a hit-and-run driver in the North Queensland city of Townsville. It's an incident that police describe as tragic, but that some others believe was intentional and racially motivated. Now a foundation's been set up in the name of Errol Wiles Jr., and his father, Errol Sr., is on the Foundation's board of directors. He joins me along with solicitor Stuart Levitt. Also on the program, the National Chief of Canada's Assembly of First Nations speaks about healing the damage inflicted on Indigenous people through the residential school system that operated in Canada for over a century.
Residential schools were about, as was described by one senior federal official, killing the Indian in the child.
Chief Phil Fontaine. Also, closer to home, we hear about Gathering Ground, a site-specific performance tour around the block in Redfern. So I hope you can stay with me. That's all coming up here on Away.
We just went to a friend's place around the corner. Then we was walking back past the party to go home. And then we seen the car pull out, and then was just pulled up beside us, sort of, in the middle of the intersection, and me and Narrell and Maddie Lampton rode up to it just to see who was in there, and then it just started taking off slowly, and when we was riding up, it just kept taking off slowly.
I saw this car pull up at the intersection, but then it stopped and reversed back quickly, and then it went forwards very quickly towards one of the boys on bikes. Then it reversed backwards out of my view, and there were noises of car hitting metal, and there was a lot of shouting, "He's trying to hit them, he's trying to hit them." He was aiming the car at young Bert Summers and then reversing back into the group of bicycles. He appeared to be trying to hit them.
I just heard it screeching in the reverse mode, and it hit me and Muddy Lampton's bikes. Clipped our back wheels and knocked us into the gutter, and then it just took off again, and then it stopped, and it skidded again, reversed back and hit Errol. The car took off, and we all ran over to see if he was okay, and I rang the ambulance.
Two detectives came. That was the investigating officers for the case. They then officially told us what had happened. And we just couldn't believe it. It took them 3 days for them to come and officially tell us that our son was killed in an incident. So I don't like to call it an accident.
The police called it an accident?
Yes. The police called it an accident, but I've read all the statements and no way it was an accident. It was very deliberate, I believe, from witness statements, that his intention was to do harm or run somebody over. And he eventually did that to my son.
That was an excerpt from A Tale of Two Townsvilles, which was produced by Claudia Taranto for Street Stories earlier this year. In June 2003, 15-year-old Errol Wiles Jr. was killed by a hit-and-run driver in the early hours of the morning outside a party in a suburban street in Townsville. The person responsible was later charged with dangerous driving, causing death. When the matter came before court, the prosecution said there was no evidence that the death of Errol Wiles was anything other than an accident. Now, a foundation has been set up to provide legal redress for victims and to ensure that Aboriginal people receive equal protection and treatment under the law, no matter where they live. I spoke with Errol Wiles Sr. and solicitor Stuart Levitt, both of whom are board directors of the Errol Wiles Justice Foundation.
Something like that to happen to one of your kids, it's heart-wrenching. We still can't wrap our minds around why would somebody do something like that. It's just, we just can't explain it.
Now, you've got other children. I think are there three other children in your family?
Yeah, I've got an older son that was just older than Errol. An older daughter, she's 23, and a younger daughter just under Errol. She's 12 this year.
Can I ask you, without being too invasive, what's been the effect of I mean, it's 3 years ago now, but these things don't go away. What's been the effect on the rest of the family with the loss of Errol Jr.?
Well, you know, loss of your child, it's like I said before, it's devastating. It's our life your life just gets turned upside down. It's very hard to explain if you haven't been through an experience like that. It's very hard to explain it, but we've sort of pulled it back together, sort of. But the pain's still there. But we know that we've got to forge on ahead and look at the positive things that we can do from here on in.
Stuart, I'll just bring you in here. Can you explain to me why you felt the need to set up a foundation, the Errol Wiles Justice Foundation, in honour of young Errol Wiles?
Because through the combined inquiries, investigations of myself, a former PI, Ian James, and also Ross Coulthart from his Sunday team, we came to the conclusion that what happened to Errol Wiles Jr. was just the tip of the iceberg, that it was being replicated in many situations of similar injustice around Northern Australia, and that there were not purely legal solutions available, particularly when this kind of under investigation, under prosecution, laissez-faire attitude to crimes against Aborigines is pretty much institutionalised in Queensland in particular and in parts of Northern Australia. And generally, there's a high degree of complacency throughout the entire Australian community. So we believe that education, media exposure, pressure locally and, if necessary, internationally, to change things in Australia, and also to ensure that there were better legal resources available to protect Aboriginal interests when faced with these kinds of situations. We've made extensive submissions to the Queensland Attorney General, who regrettably has just been replaced, and I have no confidence that the matter will be determined appropriately by the Queensland government, because the colour of the Queensland government, the cut of the Premier's jib, has been recently demonstrated by his outrageous response and support for Commissioner Atkinson's refusal to ask Senior Sergeant Hurley to stand down from the police force after the grave findings were made against Sergeant Hurley by the acting state coroner in respect of the cause of the death of the late Mulrunji Dumaji in police custody in Palm Island in 2004, having been caused by fatal actions committed by Sergeant Hurley. Mm. The fact that the Premier and the Police Commissioner can be so rigorous in their desire to bring Aborigines to heel for some damage to jerry-built government property on Palm Island in circumstances where 2.5 years, or sorry, 2 years after the event, not a single charge has been laid against anyone in connection with either suppression of evidence, misrepresentation of evidence, or the fatal actions taken by police against a man who died in police custody, and nothing has happened in that regard. No prosecution has been initiated in all this period. It just speaks volumes about the double standards and the entirely inappropriate standards of the Queensland government. And therefore, we can have no confidence that they will bring any better practice to bear or any more judicial approach to the assessment of the evidence in the Errol Wilde case.
So these two cases are conflated. You're conflating there the case of young Errol Wiles and what happened on Palm Island.
It's the lack of respect for Aboriginal life that is the common thread between the two cases. And it's not limited to those two cases. There are innumerable instances of lack of respect for Aboriginal life, for Aboriginal dignity, Aboriginal self-esteem, Aboriginal rights in general, which is a consistent theme of public policy in Australia. I mean, the way in which the federal government, for example, has handled statistical information concerning the incidence of domestic violence or paedophilia in the Aboriginal community by comparing deprived Aboriginal communities with the national average rather than within similar communities in other parts of Australia where white people live is another instance.
Errol, if I could bring you back in here, you've said before that you forgive the individual who was responsible for the death of your son.
That's right. The thing is you cannot hold on to that sort of emotion. It devastates you. It destroys you. So I wasn't about to let, or me and my wife wasn't about to let his actions affect us in a negative way. So that's why, you know, we forgive him. And but the thing is that the right thing still has to be done. Everybody's got to, I suppose, be responsible for their actions. And what I believe with what the judicial system did was took that responsibility off him.
You know, I mean, the setting up of the Errol Wiles Junior Justice Foundation, I think, is a great, a very positive thing for you to be involved in, and you're a director on the board. What do you think you can do through the mechanism of the Errol Wiles Justice Foundation to, I guess, to ensure that the young Errol really didn't die needlessly, that we can do something to change these acts of violence that are committed against Aboriginal people?
Well, hopefully we can make changes in the future, hopefully with legislation as well, hopefully, that this doesn't happen to another family again, whether it's Aboriginal or white Australians, you know. The thing that shouldn't happen at all. Justice was denied in the first place. You know, it should have been freely given. I think through the foundation, I think that we can make a lot of changes in the wider community, especially through building bridges and understanding between Aboriginal culture and Australia, wide Australia, you know. Hopefully we can break down a lot of the barriers that are out there and start getting people to start getting them to start thinking for themselves, really, rather than just seeing stereotype images or just hearing other things from other people rather than experiencing and meeting other people from our culture and that.
Stuart, is that how you see the work of the foundation? You know, the constitution talks about building bridges between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians.
That's right. Well, one of the ways of building bridges is to increase the knowledge of white Australians of their history and as it is impacted upon black Australians, to understand that it's not about reconciliation at all, because we never had a decent relationship with the Aborigines. It was always an exploitative and oppressive relationship. And we have to restore the Aborigines to the position of being autonomous, independent, self-respecting people who are able to access fully the rights which this country is able to bestow upon them. And we can only do that if we remove all the obstacles that we've set in their way from that realisation. The fact is that by giving people self-respect, you actually give them the opportunity to be free, And there was a very famous saying by a great rabbi to the effect that if I am not for myself, who will be for me? And we have to ensure that Aborigines recognise with pride all that they have achieved and in their history and what the contribution that they can make, and we should ensure that white Australia does nothing to interfere with or trammel the ability of Aborigines to access their past and enrich our society and be enriched by it.
We can make a lot of changes, and I believe that if people just I suppose go to their hearts and just pull things from the heart rather than what they see and hear and stuff like that, I believe that they can just hear and see properly that things will change.
Errol Wiles Sr. speaking from Townsville, and Stuart Levitt, the principal of Levitt Robinson Solicitors. The Queensland Police Service says allegations about the way the incident was investigated were referred to its Ethical Standards Committee, which found they were unsubstantiated. Both Errol Wiles Sr. and Stuart Levitt are board directors of the Errol Wiles Justice Foundation. If you'd like to know more about the work of the foundation, just go to errolwiles.com or go to the Away homepage, where you'll find a link to the website. And a note too that the Tale of Two Townsvilles program produced by Claudia Taranto for Street Stories will be replayed over the summer here on ABC Radio National. Bit of saltwater country. That was the Pigram Brothers and their track End of Time off the album Gia. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Away. Phil Fontaine, the National Chief of Canada's Assembly of First Nations, was in Australia recently. Chief Fontaine has been prominent in negotiating a vast range of agreements between First Nations communities and the Canadian government, including a $1.9 billion settlement announced in May this year. The Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement addresses almost a century of grievance for Canada's First Nations. Children recorded at a residential school in British Columbia around Christmas 1962 for a Canadian Broadcasting Corporation documentary. The residential schools were a legacy of Canada's missionary history and became the machinery for stripping away Indigenous culture in the name of integrating Indigenous children into mainstream society. The schools were run as joint ventures between the five main churches and the Government of Canada. It's estimated that at the time they began closing in the early 1970s, there were 130 of them across most provinces and territories. There are around 80,000 people alive today who attended the residential schools. In October 1990, Phil Fontaine, a former student at a residential school at a settlement called Fort Alexander in Manitoba, broke decades of silence by speaking publicly about the abuse he and others experienced as part of that system.
Some chilling allegations today about abuse of Manitoba Indian children in the past during the days when they were forced to attend boarding schools. Those residential schools run by white clergy were shut down 2 decades ago. But today, one of the country's most prominent chiefs called for an inquiry, saying he was one of the victims.
Phil Fontaine, the head of Manitoba's Assembly of Indian Chiefs, called in representatives from the Catholic Church today to demand an investigation. He says he was abused by school staff, so were others.
The sexual abuse did occur. We were aware of it. We have experience, collective experience. Physical abuse took place, psychological abuse, deprivation, and all of the other things.
Fontaine says he was sexually abused on the Fort Alexander Reserve north of Winnipeg. Only a few cabins remain today of the residential school he was forced by law to attend, a school for natives like many others which dotted the prairies until the late 60s.
One of the conference organizers is the chief of the Soda Creek Band, Bev Sellers. She spoke this morning about the physical, psychological, and sexual abuse suffered by many of the children who went
to the schools. Had such an impact on Native people as a whole because the majority of our communities were required to attend them. It seems the only ones that didn't attend the schools were the ones that were too sick to do the manual labor that was required, or the children whose parents took them into the wilderness and managed to hide them for a while. But I think there are very few that managed to completely escape being sent to the schools.
The events of October 1990 as captured by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. 16 years later, and the $1.9 billion settlement agreement is about to come into effect. Now into his third term as National Chief of Canada's Assembly of First Nations, Phil Fontaine has been travelling with colleagues in Australia, talking about the impact of the residential school system on Indigenous Canadians and what role the settlement plays in the process of national reconciliation.
The issue of the residential school experience was something that was not well known, and is still not as well known as it ought to be in Canada. You could go to any university or post-secondary institution in high school in Canada, and you were to ask a professor, a university student, or a high school student about the experience, they'd put up their hands and say, well, we know nothing about the experience, right? What are residential schools? What is a residential school? And as important as the residential school experience has been, little of it is known, right? Little is known about the abuse that was inflicted on our people. Little is known about why residential schools and boarding schools were established. Little is known about the abuse that was inflicted on our peoples. The sexual abuse, the physical abuse, the psychological abuse that was inflicted on too many of our people. Too many of our people. And the consequences of this experience has been absolutely devastating on our people. And for the longest time, there is absolutely no interest on the part of government to resolve this issue. As far as government was concerned, the residential school experience was good. Residential schools were about making us better Canadians. Residential schools, as I said, were about Christianizing us and teaching us the values that were held as important by Canadians generally. And it just didn't work. You can't do that to any peoples in any part of the world. You just can't come in and impose your will on a peoples. And Canada learned too late, right, about the effects and consequences of this experience. And so we had to work extremely hard to convince the Canadian government that the resolution of this issue in a fair and just way was so incredibly important. Right? And the sooner we are able to resolve this issue, the better off we were all going to be. And I'm not just talking about the survivors, I'm talking about Canadians generally. Because the residential school experience is a stain on Canada. Right? And the only way we are going to deal with this was to acknowledge the harms that were inflicted on our people. Right? And so the very first public gesture was the Statement of Reconciliation in 1998, when the Canadian government, as a result of all of the hard work that was done by so many people and the Royal Commission report and its recommendation that called for an apology, that we were finally able to move the Canadian government some distance, not as far as we knew was necessary. But the Statement of Reconciliation and the $350 million healing fund was a very important step forward. Right? And we knew then that as soon as the statement was rendered, that our people would be emboldened and encouraged to take action, right, to have their individual abuse issues resolved or dealt with. And that's exactly what happened. People started filing claims. People started bringing forward charges. And to the point where today there are approximately 15,000 individual claims before the courts, plus 21 national class action lawsuits. But that didn't happen overnight, right? It didn't happen overnight. It took incredible courage on the part of so many people to bring forward their individual experiences that were painful, shameful, and hurtful, right? It took incredible courage, and I applaud those people that that had the courage to bring these very personal matters forward. And the pivotal point for us was when the University of Calgary hosted a conference. And the theme of that conference was, is reconciliation possible? Right? And we brought together about 250 people from across the country, survivors, elders, lawyers, church representatives, and the government representatives, including the then minister, the Honorable Dennis Codera, was responsible for the file. And we met, and we talked, and we shared our experiences. And at the end of 3 days, it became very obvious to all gathered there that the government's response was not going to do it. It was not going to do it. We were never going to be able to resolve this matter in a fair and just way under that approach, right? And so I went to the deputy minister and I said, look, it's very clear here that something else is needed. Why don't you give us an opportunity to put together an option? And our team put together a report, the Assembly of First Nations report that we brought forward in November 2004, and that set out what we considered the way forward, right? The elements that that had to be included in any response from the government that we knew and understood would bring about a resolution. And we talked about it for months. Finally, the government said, okay, we're ready to enter into a political agreement with you. And in the political agreement, we agree that the main principles and elements that are outlined in your report will be incorporated in the political agreement, right? Including a lump sum payment, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, commemoration, an early payment to the elderly, compensation for legal counsel, an endowment to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation so that it could continue its very important work as a result that came about as a result of the $350 million healing fund. And very important and essential improvements to the ADR, the Alternative Dispute Resolution, that was established as a result of the government's concern to the number of claims that were put before the courts, right, these 15,000 claims. And they understood that the courts weren't going to be able to deal with these claims. There are too many. And in fact, they understood, because we pressed them, that the court process was too adversarial. And the courts were going to end up re-victimizing the survivors. And so all of these elements were incorporated in the political agreement that we signed on May the 30th, 2005. And of course, we had an uncertain event come to visit us, right? The government fell, and a new government came into power on January the 23rd. The Conservative Party formed the government, albeit with a very slim minority. And we didn't know whether they were going to honor the agreement. We didn't know, because it was a substantial financial package in the order of $5 billion, right, with a number of very important elements, including the Truth Commission, the very first time that a first world country, if I can put it that way, right, had ever agreed to a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And we were uncertain, right, whether the government would agree to this. And we had a number of discussions, and the government finally, through its cabinet, approved the agreement in principle on May the 10th, 2006. And on the understanding that the agreement, because it's a legal agreement, right, has to go before 9 jurisdictions in Canada, and the courts have to give their stamp, right? And we are down to the last jurisdiction, right? Once that is done, the agreement will then go to the survivors, the approximately 80,000 survivors. And it will be up to each survivor to decide for themselves whether the agreement is acceptable, right? And we believe that the approximately 80,000 survivors will say yes to the agreement. The importance of this agreement is that it will enable the country, Canada, to finally turn the page on this tragic chapter, right? And we will finally be able to get on with the rest of our lives, to be able to put behind us this very shameful, tragic, hurtful experience, this very dark chapter that's hung over Canada like a dark cloud, right? We will finally be able to put that aside, because what will be before the survivors and before the country is an opportunity to right a historic wrong, right? And this agreement will enable the survivors that have suffered to be able to deal with this pain, knowing that the agreement that's before them is fair and just.
Phil Fontaine, the National Chief of Canada's Assembly of First Nations, recorded recently at the Australian National University in Canberra. The production was by Duncan Lowe and Stuart Hall. Before we leave Canada, a beautiful Nutchinult farewell song from Vancouver Island. The main singer in this recording is George Clutzy, who died in 1988 after a long career as an artist, broadcaster, writer and performer. George Clutzy is considered the reviver of Northwest Coast Indigenous songs and dances. In the late 1940s, after gaining government permission to practice his culture, he began teaching songs to children in the same residential school that he'd attended some 4 decades earlier. The custodian of this song was Chief Adam Shuish of Port Alberni on Vancouver Island. The words are from a language that's no longer spoken. But it begins with the line, "We are but an echo of the past."
Why
Nuchinult Farewell Song performed by George Clootzy in 1974 and just re-released on the Smithsonian Folkways label in collaboration with the University of Alberta in Canada. I'm Daniel Browning and you're listening to Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on ABC Radio National. Gathering Ground is a site-specific performance tour, a collaborative project which brings together artists and residents of the block in Redfern in Inner Sydney. Rather than taking place on a theatre stage, the performance is site-specific, moving across three sites down on the block along Everleigh Street. The block and its residents have long been demonised, with a senior politician once suggesting the only way to clean up the area was to bulldoze it. But Redfern and the block have long been a gathering place for Aboriginal people. Once they were free to leave the missions and reserves in the 1960s, people from out west gravitated there to find their family. Some never left. Once a vibrant centre of urban Aboriginal life, most would agree the block is now a shadow of its former self. Buildings have been demolished, houses have been boarded up, and families have moved out. But it's still home to a community. It was down on the block that I met up with the young people behind Gathering Ground: Aletha Penrith, Alan Clark, and Willeri Kirkbright-Burney, along with director Kaz Therese from Pact Youth Theatre and mentor Lily Shearer, the Indigenous performance broker at the Performance Space in Redfern.
Redfern is one of the most historically important places in New South Wales, I think. So much of Aboriginal people's human rights has come from this area, and so much of Aboriginal people's history is from this place. You know, you walk down the street and people you bump into call you by your first name. There's such an amazing sense of community and focus on family, all the things which are really important to Aboriginal culture, but things that have helped our culture survive.
Okay, so now tell us, Alan, about the production itself. It moves in stages at various sites. Give our listeners a sense of what Gathering Ground does in the sense that it's a performance tour more than just a performance. It's not a static staged performance.
Yeah, we hope to take people on a journey, essentially, from the beginning of the block to the future of the block, in terms of being a metaphor, I guess. But you know, what we hope to do is lead people in the form of a protest that, you know, one of the many protests that have passed through Redfern, and then take them to specific sites, you know, that are really important to the block and to the Aboriginal community in the inner city. Not only that, but, you know, families from out west and families from down the coast. So, I mean, it's just envisioning something that once was, because as you look around, a lot of the houses are gone, a lot of the families are gone, you know, a lot of places are boarded up, very important places, like Murrawina. And so, and hopefully we get to, you know, breathe some life back into that and actually, you know, give people the opportunity to see something they'd never see before or never know about. I mean, even a lot of the younger community members don't even know about specific sites and what happened there and what was born from that. So just be good to, you know, re-educate and reinvigorate the spirit of the block, I guess.
So you're hoping for young kids to join Gathering Ground as it moves, as the performance moves?
Yeah, well, like little kids from, you know, teenage years to, I think, as young as 4 or 5 are hugely involved in the Gathering Ground project. So, yeah, that's going to be deadly. It's going to give them a sense of their own empowerment and what their own community means to them, you know, and have that appreciated by an outside audience, hopefully.
This is one of the largest cities in Australia, and it is very different for Aboriginal people living in an urban environment as opposed to a blackfella living in the bush or somewhere where they have more access and more ability to keep all their history and their ceremonies alive. It's really, really hard for Koori people in the city, and that's half the reason that Redfern holds such an incredible significance to our people. It's not somewhere that should be feared and looked down upon. It shouldn't, you know, there are so many people that think it's just a really horrible place full of negative aspects and you never see in the media. And I really do believe that Redfern and the block particularly is under immediate threat from real estate, from corporations who kind of, I believe, would prefer not to have such a large Aboriginal community around here. And I think that's something that everyone in Sydney and everyone in New South Wales needs to take a stand against. We can't lose Redfern and we can't lose the block.
Yes, so it's kind of coming out of, like, talking to artists like Alan Clark and another step-up artist, Sunny Dallas Law, and just, you know, creating initiatives that for just graduates of Eora and NASDA, we're giving them opportunities after they graduate. So it's kind of looking at, you know, getting... I just realised that there weren't a lot of opportunities for young Indigenous artists to make art, and just basically setting up platforms for that to happen. And that's then Lily Shearer's come on board as well, and she's at the performance space. So that's kind of just a bit of research and talking to some artists who want to create work and want to create work that is, you know, contemporary Aboriginal work. And yeah.
What do you think people will get out of Gathering Ground? What are you hoping they'll get out of the performance?
More knowledge and understanding of our history, ceremony and protest over the last 218 years, particularly in the later years when Redfern was inundated with families and people came here looking for their mobs. I myself came here 30 years ago to Murrawina Hostel to further educate myself from Bawarana, to attend the Aboriginal Islander Dance Theatre. So I feel like I've done the big 30-year circle. And it's great. It's people that I grew up here as a teenager with are still around. You know, it's really disappointing and sad to see that the houses are gone and the families are gone. So to reinvigorate and stimulate the community to, save the block, to be self-determined and have our own path and deal with the social issues, because if we don't deal with the social issues, then we're not going to move on. We're not be able to get to be self-determined, and to deal with the social issues, we have to put in place programs such as this to empower our young people and to keep that fire in the belly burning.
So do you think we've lost that fire in the belly? I mean, in terms of just the survival of Redfern as a community in the inner city, do you think we've lost that fight, or do you think it's, you know, there's still a hope for a Redfern that's vibrant and that's live and that's full of Aboriginal people?
Well, I think the fire just dulled down a little bit. It's always been on the back burner. It's always passionate in people's hearts and minds and spirit. But we, just to get it up and flamed again, we really need to get it, get that flame going, and you know, especially passing that legacy on, as Aletha always reminds us, to the legacy that we've inherited, the legacy that our young people are inheriting now, and our children and our grandchildren. It's really important, and you know, future leaders, you know, we want to, I know I want to see them for the sake of my grandchildren and their children, and young people like Willa Rye and Aletha and Alan, and given the opportunity by PAC to do this with all the different art forms is just fantastic. And you know, art and theatre is education.
I guess you're hoping for people from outside of the Redfern community to come along to Gathering Ground, so that you're actually educating people from outside as well as you know, our own mob here at Redfern.
Yeah, well, both of those things. And you know, I just ask people to remember that Redfern is a national and international icon. You know, Black America identify with the Black community in an urban environment, and they certainly, their artists come over here from the Fugees. I've seen Ice Cube down the block here, you know, when I was living down here as a teenager. There have been, you know, amazing people who have come and lent their support to the block, and we want to see that continue. We want this place to stay here for the long run.
How have you seen the blockchain that changed then in your lifetime? I mean, it must have changed dramatically in the last 15 years.
It changed massively. I used to live down 36 Everly, and, you know, I saw the beginning of heroin come in, and most of my mates and that, like, I mean, let's not be gammon about it, budgie about it. We're all into engaged in illegal activity and that. But so many of those people got... and the attitude towards heroin was there. Then was like, look at them fellas, look how they go on that, you know? But so many people, because it became, I guess, accepted in a way, that, you know, people just started to get used to it and see it as a normal part of the block. And, yeah, a lot of those people that I used to hang around with are either locked up or have passed on, you know? And it's very sad to see, and it's certainly not something I want my children to experience.
And I think that the use of heroin here has become an excuse for the government to dismantle this community.
Well, you know, let's talk about that. You know, basically, this being a broken down community and society means that the land value here has dropped. And so this is prime property in the centre of the city, you know. Any developer with any brains would want to come here and grab up this land, and this is a perfect excuse to do it. And, you know, it would not surprise me if we find out later that developers are behind people like Frank Sartor, who are pushing, you know, for the removal of the block or for the minimalisation of the block, you know.
One of the most important things about Gathering Grounds is that the performances that everyone's going to see who comes are all going to come from workshops which have come from children around this area, the young people who live in this area and that have their families involved with it. And it's actually about them getting a chance to have their say and actually getting to put their opinions about the block forward, regardless of whether there's 5 people here to watch it or, you know, 500 people here to watch it. It's really important that they get a say, and it's about them being able to express themselves.
Willa Rye, Kirkbride Burney, Aletha Penrith and Alan Clark, the young artists and performers behind the Gathering Ground Theatre Project, which takes place in Redfern over 3 nights towards the end of next week. Also in there, director Kaz Therese from Pact Youth Theatre, and Lily Shearer, who's the Indigenous performance broker at the Performance Space Contemporary Arts venue in Redfern. That's our program for another week. Away is produced by Matthew Leonard and me, Daniel Browning, with technical production by Louis Mitchell. I'll be back with you next week, Friday afternoon at 1, 4 p.m. in the West, and Saturday evening at 6, with more Indigenous art and culture here on ABC Radio National. I'll catch up with you then, but for now, have a great weekend.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.